Hello, everybody. Welcome to week two of Indians baseball, and this is going to be the third episode of Burning River Radio. I'm Joe,
And I'm Mike.
and we are Burning River Radio.
And Indians finally return home after a six-game road trip in which they went 500. In my opinion, it was a very impressive 500, although it was pretty they were the offense was pretty bipolar most of the road trip. But coming back home after facing both remaining or both reigning, I should say, Cy Young Award winners and Justin Masterson beat them both, I think it was a pretty successful road trip.
Yeah, absolutely. I think going into this, they won the first two games, so you always kind of get crazy and hope, oh, maybe they can go 6-0, or they can go 3-0, sweeps the Blue Jays, and then they of course lost three games right after they won the first two. That kind of brings you back down to earth. But for the most part, they were in every game, and they were pretty close games when they lost, except for the last loss. But the first two were pretty close, and the wins were all solid too. And they didn't have as much trouble scoring runs as they did last year, except for in the two games against Tampa there.
Yeah, and I think what was really exciting was that final game that Myers pitched, in which the Indians lost in Toronto. I mean, they kept on clawing back. Every time Toronto would score, the Indians would come right back and score. And I mean, they had the Blue Jays definitely had the and their bullpen certainly had to earn that victory in Toronto. So, and that was fun to watch because last year, I mean, if the Indians were down early or if they were down any more than two or three runs, I mean, it was just turn off the TV
Oh yeah,
time.
as soon as they got down, you could just kind of see them, especially the starting pitcher. Like if the starting pitcher gave up three runs in the first inning, he was like, "Oh, I guess I just lost this one. Move on to the next game." And a lot of times they'd keep giving up runs, but you could tell that they just weren't in it because they knew the offense wasn't capable. But this year, they really did a great job in that game coming back. And yesterday was insane. They scored 13 runs against David Price started that game. They scored 8 runs off of him. And I think Mark Reynolds really deserves a lot of credit. He was one of the more undervalued signings. He was one of the first signings in the offseason. And when Swisher signed, everyone kind of forgot about him. But he's only here on a 1 year deal, and he's making a lot less money than the other guys. But he's already hit 4 home runs, and two of them were yesterday.
Yeah, it was like you said, it was a very under when they signed Mark Reynolds, obviously the signing of Nick Swisher overshadowed any other signing the rest of the season, with the exception of maybe Michael Bourne. But Reynolds, I mean, he was that guy that we didn't have last year, a right-handed power hitter that can DH.
I mean,
And
a power hitter from either side of the plate, really. They haven't had a guy who is capable of hitting more than 20 home runs in a year, basically since Grady did it. Pronk did it before him, but the last few years he wasn't really on that level. So just having a guy who, and I mean, if he hits 4 in a week, you'd expect he's going to hit at least 25 this year, I'd hope.
I would think so, and if he hits at least 25, I mean, you can definitely put up with the 200 strikeouts he's going to give you too.
I don't even know that he's gonna strike out 200 times. I know we made jokes about it before the season started, and we actually have a strikeout tracker on the side of the page. But every day I open up the strikeout tracker to update it, and every day the Indians are not anywhere near first place as far as striking out the most. The Houston Astros are just destroying everybody as far as that goes. They've struck out 74 times already in 6 games. That's fairly insane. More than 10 times a game. The Indians are ranked 12th. That's not ba out of 30. So, I mean,
Right.
to the idea that they're going to actually break the team record for strikeouts even or break the AL record is kind of far-fetched at this point. They really have they've had bad games striking out, but they're not as bad as some of these other teams out there.
Not right now, but take it easy. It's only 1 week into the season, bro. So we still got a long ways to go. But I mean, I'm just saying in general, I mean, 25 home runs from a guy that hits right-handed, you're going to put up with the 200 strikeouts without a doubt.
Oh yeah, and I think And you'd love to have a guy who hit more than 25 home runs. I mean, back in the day, 25 home runs was your utility infielder. They had, I think back in like '99 or whatever, and they had Richie Sexton and all them. They had like six guys hit over 20 home runs. But the fact is, it doesn't really happen anymore. There's two or three guys in the league who can still hit 40, and even that's kind of rare. It's just the chances of the Indians having one of those guys who are going to hit 40 home runs is pretty much non-existent, and there's no one on this team that's going to do that. Even Swisher, with all the talk they have, his max is about 20 home runs,
Right.
and he has struggled a little bit this year so far.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the road trip was a 500, the old adage goes, obviously, if you can play 500 ball on the road and then come home and win two out of three and just win series at home, then you're going to be a playoff contender. Now, in my opinion, to go a little bit further, you need at least two legitimate starting pitchers at the top of your rotation. I'd like five, but two guys that you know are going to be streak stoppers, and guys are going to go out and give you probably six plus innings. Strike out more than they walk, which we've had issues with in years past. And I think this road trip showed that Masterson and Jimenez have certainly improved over last season, and that's what I'm.
At
That's
least for a day,
at least for one game.
or
Well,
2 days for Masterson.
Masterson for two. I mean, Masterson you wasn't too worried about, but Jimenez that start against Toronto was, I think, it look he looked like Ubaldo of 2010.
Now, before you get ahead of yourself too far, last year he did have quite a few really good starts. He wasn't terrible. Like, if you look at his average numbers, it's kind of like if you look at the average runs scored that the Indians had against Tampa. It looks like they scored almost 5 runs a game.
Right.
But in reality, they scored zero twice, and then they, scored 13. So when you look at his numbers, Ubaldo's numbers from last year, they look just terrible. But he had plenty of games in there, and I remember at least one against Texas and one against Detroit, where he was outstanding. And he looked exactly like he did yesterday with that with the curveball that just drops like 3 feet. It's he was very good in a couple games and very terrible in almost every other game.
Yeah, it's certainly the law of averages, but it was certainly encouraging, that's for sure.
Yeah, and truthfully, I prefer a guy who is great one day and then terrible the next almost more than a guy who's average every day, because on that great day, you're almost certain to win. If he's average every day, then you can lose every day. Like, if he has a 5 ERA and he allows 5 runs every single game, or, somewhere around there, if he doesn't pitch 9 innings, obviously. But if he's allowing 4 or 5 runs every single game, there's a chance your offense is never going to win behind him. But if he pitches a shutout or a 1-run game and then next time out gives up 10, you're probably going to go 500 when he's on the mound.
So what you're saying is you'd rather take a guy, or you would prefer a guy with, say he, throughout the course of the season he earns 6 wins above replacement. Okay, he has a, let's give him a 70% chance. No, let's go lower. He has a 40% chance of earning 6 wins above replacement. Or are you going to take a guy with a 60% chance of earning 4 wins above replacement?
I don't like the way the stat works there, just because we're like what I'm talking about now is individual games rather than your total over the whole season.
Well, I know, but looking at the big picture, obviously, you're looking at, I mean, according to what you're talking about, if you take a snapshot of a player's season, he has one awful game, he's awful. So you have to take into account the entire season.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, you could have two pitchers, one of them who every game does the exact same thing, and let's say gives up 3 runs in 6 innings,
Right.
And then you could have another pitcher who one game gives up no runs in 6 innings, and then the next game gives up 6 runs in 6 innings. Those guys are going to have identical ERAs. They're probably going to have identical WARs as far as I know. You know, like the stats are going to be exactly the same. But the guy who gives up zero runs that one, you know, every other time, you have a much better chance of at least going 500 when he's pitching.
Okay. I understand what you're saying now. You just approached it. You didn't take a strict mathematical approach to it like I did. And I
Right.
probably confused the hell out of everybody listening, but oh well.
Well, then I found the like one game last year I've got from Ubaldo. Oh, this is actually perfect because if you go back through this stretch, he pitched one game, had pitched four innings and allowed seven runs. The next game he comes back, pitches 6 2/3, one run, and he gets the win. So he got the loss and he got the win when he pitched 6 2/3 and only allowed one run. Next game, seven innings, seven strikeouts, one run on a solo home run. Then 6 innings, he allowed four runs. That's either way, but he lost that game. So you can
Right.
see, like, they win the two that he pitched well, and they lost that one. Then he comes out 6 2/3, a shutout, 8 Ks. Obviously, he won that one. Then they lose his next start because he gave up four runs in 6 innings. So it's always going back and forth, and it really is like allow one run or allow four runs or allow five runs every single game for him. So his start in today, we're recording this on was it Monday, Tuesday? I don't know. Yeah, Monday. The first game of the
Joe
league.
doesn't even know what day it is.
I don't.
Unbelievable.
It's nice not to
I,
know
you know
what day it
what?
is, but.
I, that doesn't surprise me one bit. But go ahead.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what he does against the Yankees today. If he can keep that streak going, if he can keep that curveball, if he can keep throwing a fastball for strikes, which is probably the most important thing. Because he can throw the curveball for strikes, and he can throw the curveball and get him to swing and miss at it. It's whether he's behind, ahead or behind the count, that really
Oh, it's
affects our
interesting.
stats.
Against that start against Toronto, though, I was looking over the numbers, and when he had that breakout year against with the Rockies, okay, he threw his curveball according to PitchFX data from BrooksBaseball.com. He threw his curveball 9.3% of the time. Even last year, he was throwing his curveball 9% of the time. So he still had that in his arsenal.
Yeah, but it's the
Against the
counts
Blue
that he's
Jays.
getting in where he's, you know, throwing so many balls beforehand, there's no reason to swing at it.
Well, but that brings me to the point that I was trying to make before I was so rudely interrupted,
Yeah, what's gonna happen?
was he only threw his curveball 2.5% of the time against Toronto. So
It was good when he threw it.
but he has very little command over it. I mean, last year you had no idea. As soon as the curveball left his hand, and hitters just didn't. I mean, they didn't anticipate it. They didn't guess it. They were either guessing fastball or slider. And I mean, they just took the. So instead of him worrying about and getting behind in the count by throwing a curveball early in the count, he didn't against Toronto.
No, I
And
think
I
he
think that was
saved
one
it.
of the keys to his success.
He saved it to late in the count, which is what you want to do. You get him down in the count, and then you can throw at the end. That's his strikeout pitch. Just like Masterson yesterday was throwing that slider, and that's not really his primary pitch. But man, it looked good yesterday, and he had guys swinging at things that were almost. By the time Santana caught it, it looked like it was 6 inches inside the plate, but I
Yeah,
think
it
it crossed in the strike zone. It was crazy.
Yeah, he yeah, his slider yesterday was unbelievable.
All right, so we want to move on to the next game. We just spent a lot of time talking about that was a game two of the season last week that the Indians won. Game three, the Indians lost. That one was not quite as exciting. That was the one we were talking about. Reynolds hit the home run, and they were actually Reynolds and Santana both hit home runs that day, and they were, you know, trying to come back over and over and over again. And I believe that Terry Francona made his first mistake of the year in that game. In the fifth inning, let me get the exact thing up here. But basically, in the fifth inning, you had Myers was still in. He gave up a single, a walk, and then a home run. To me, you're that late in the game. You're giving up home runs still. It was 6-3 at that point, which is really, you know, I don't, you don't know at the time, you don't know how good the offense is going to be or whatever. You don't know, is a 3-run lead that late in the game insurmountable, whatever. So the Toronto's up 6-3 because they just hit a 3-run home run. The Indians score 3 the next inning, and rather than pulling Myers, Francona stuck with him. And of course, the first batter in the inning was J.P. Arencibia, and he hits his second home run of the game. So that, and then he was pulled immediately after that. So he only pitched to one guy. He gave up the home run. They brought in Cody Allen, who I think that's a good choice to bring in this situation. It's a 1-run game at that point, but they had just used they used Pestano, Smith, and Perez in each of the first two games. So you didn't want to go to them again. Allen hadn't pitched yet in the year, so they bring in Allen. Allen gives up a home run himself. So it's 2 home runs in the inning, and then he had an error later, which they actually called an error on Reynolds, but it shouldn't have been. Yeah, anyway, so that's
So,
yeah.
go
So
ahead.
basically, it brings up a topic that we've discussed a lot in the past, but never on the show here, which is the subject of manager wins, or can a manager affect the game on a long-term scale, on a short-term scale? What can you do to affect the game? I think this is something originally you came up with, but we've kind of gone back and forth with it a lot in the past few years.
Well, in that particular situation, I completely agree with Terry Francona. Terry Francona, what he does is he looks at, and this is what managers should do. I mean, look at, let's go back to the basics. Manager. Okay? There's a reason why he's called a manager in baseball and not a coach. Okay? It's because he is assigned to manage players on the field. Okay? Now, baseball, when you're playing 162 games, okay, you have to look at the big picture. You just can't take snapshots of a week, of a game, of a series. You have to look at the big picture. You have to tell your players to take it one game at a time, but you as the manager have to look at the big picture. And I completely agree with him. I mean, his bullpens, when he managed in both Philadelphia and Boston, his bullpens were some of the least used in Major League Baseball. He has a very, very long leash with his starting pitchers. We knew that coming in when he became the manager of the Indians.
Well, I
So
questioned that
the
a little
fact that
bit this year, just because yesterday Justin Masterson was pitching. He pitched 7 innings, had less than 100 pitches, and they didn't let him finish a shutout. Now, obviously, they didn't need him to finish a shutout, so it didn't affect the game win or loss at all, but they wouldn't let him pitch those final 2 innings.
Well, again, I agree with Terry there only because they had such a big lead when he got the hook that, I mean, the Indians, because of their good bullpen, now I guess you could use this as an argument on your side too, but because they have a really solid bullpen from start to finish, you know, with that big of a lead, again, looking at the big picture, you don't want Justin going out there
Oh no,
for an extra
and you
inning
know
going
what?
for
And
extra
I agree
pitches.
with the move yesterday as a, as far as the best, giving the Indians the best chance to win, not just that game, but the next game that Masterson pitches, and keeping Masterson healthy, it was definitely the right move because you don't want him to get hurt throwing pitch 110 in the ninth inning in a 13-run game. That would be
Right.
stupid. So I agree with it there, but on a fan side of view, where I like to see a complete game shutout, and I haven't seen one. I think Derek Lowe threw one last year, and generally you don't get more than one or two a year. When you got a guy that's as on fire as Masterson was, he had 8 strikeouts in 7 innings. You know, when you have a guy pitching like that, it would be nice to see him throw at least 8 innings and then let the other guy throw the ninth. But yeah, I mean, but obviously because of that, he wasn't, you know, so keen on leaving him in for the entire game. Even in the home opener, or not the home opener, the opener in Toronto, Masterson only pitched 6 innings and he only gave up a single run. And then Ubaldo comes out the next day, he gives up 1 run and he's pulled after 6 innings. So it's not like he's leaving these starters in there forever.
Well, again, managers are privy to information that we're not. And there's a reason why fans aren't managers or coaches of professional or college teams. because they know a lot and they have a lot more proprietary information than we do. So there are reasons why managers and coaches do what they do, and some of those reasons won't even make it to the media so that we can further discuss it. I mean, who knows what was said in that game? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, so anyway, we're talking about the Myers game still, and to me, it just seems when a pitcher is struggling that bad, you don't have to try to keep and force it and make him throw another inning. And I don't think it was because Allen came in during the middle of an inning that he gave up those runs. That had nothing to do with anything. Like I said, that was the right move, bringing Allen there. But I do think that that goes to Francona, that home run in particular should go to him. So is like, is there any way to quantify it, where you have something like that, where there's a call that's obviously a questionable call, or could be questionable whether in that inning or if he had stayed in even after that, did he pull him too, did he pull anybody too soon, just that type of question. Which did they call for a sacrifice bunt, which I don't believe he's done yet this year. They have had a sacrifice bunt, but I don't think Francona called that one. So like, is there any way to quantify that type of thing as far as a manager goes to really judge whether a manager is good or not?
Well, I mean, there's been attempts by Baseball Prospectus and Fangraphs. It's just really hard because there's so many moving parts. I mean, the game of, I mean, within the game, there's so many dynamic parts throughout the course of a nine-inning game that the manager ultimately, it's hard to tell whether he makes the final decision on a certain, for instance, a player stealing a base. Does he make the call? Does the base stealer make the call? Do one of the base coaches make the call? One of the things that we can probably try to quantify are pitching changes, and Baseball Prospectus has sort of done that with pitcher abuse points and stuff like that. But just there's so many different moving parts in the course of a baseball game. It's just really hard to quantify that. I mean, how would you quantify that?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You'd have to do it on an individual basis. And just like anything else, when a batter gets a hit, you add up the hit. You don't really think, oh, it's a single, that's that big of a deal. But at the end of the year, you look at his average, and then you can kind of judge how good of a hitter he was based on the, his rate stats. So I think you kind of would have to have something like that for the manager, whereas every inning from, let's say, the fifth inning on or whatever, that he leaves the guy in or when he takes the guy out. The problem is you don't know how much of that to blame on him, because it has to be, I think it has to be previous knowledge. If he knows ahead of time that a pitcher has trouble facing a certain hitter or a certain type of hitter, and he leaves him in anyway, then that's a manager mistake. Unless, of course, the pitcher does well, and then all of a sudden he looks like a genius. So it really is hard to, to tell exactly what's going on there. Even like if he puts in a pinch hitter and he hits a home run or he strikes out. I mean, those are really hard to tell because over the course of the season, that hitter could do anything in any one at bat. So it just happened to be that one at bat that he did it in.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and you know. Just giving you an example, it probably doesn't happen so much in Major League Baseball as it does, further down in college and high school. But I mean, you could be given the take sign and swing away because you think the pitch is in your wheelhouse, and you could hit a home run. And but
Yeah,
I
like
mean,
Tony Peña.
something like something, yeah, something, something like that would never ever reach the media, so we wouldn't be able to criticize the manager or the player for one way or the other. But see, here's the thing: good managers. If you were to agree that good managers should adapt to the players that they have on the roster instead of being stubborn with certain principles and philosophies if they don't have the right personnel on their team, then over the course of a manager's career, over the course of a year, because there's so much turnover on the roster because of injuries and whatnot throughout the course of the year, it's really hard to really find out if a manager has, quote, a book or not. You know, what are managers' philosophies? That's hard to quantify because there's so many, like I said, so many moving parts. And
Well, you know, I.
in my opinion, a good manager adapts to the roster that he has.
Yeah, and I think, but you can kind of tell a little bit about Francona's philosophy, at least compared to what ACTA was or Wedge was. back way back then. He's definitely not a small ball guy. He's definitely more of the 3 walks and a home run, or 2 walks and a home run, or whatever the
Yeah,
old
right.
Weaver thing was. But I think he's definitely more towards that. I don't think he's a big stealing bases guy, at least, especially from what we've seen so far. I mean, Michael Bourne has stolen at least 40 bases like for a decade, and he has one steal so far. You got Reynolds has 4 home runs and he didn't even play in one game, and Bourne hasn't stolen a single a base, and pretty much no one else has even attempted a steal. Kipnis hasn't tried to steal, and he was big for the Indians last year. Brantley hasn't tried to steal. Azrubel tried to steal and got caught, but it was a pickoff thing, so that was kind of weird. Yeah, so they really haven't been using that base running thing, even in the 2 games that they lost in shutouts, where they did have some guys on, and you're thinking maybe he's gonna try some stealing, hit and run. No, he kind of just let it go.
Well, it depends on who's at the plate too. I mean, look at the Indians lineup, and it's uniquely constructed to that. I mean, they've got players that have a certain, say, Michael Bourne is up or Jason Kipnis is up. They can do maybe a suicide squeeze. It depends on, who's on base, who's at the plate. So it's kind of so even then, I mean, the Indians lineup is so unique that I think if Terry Francona is wise, he's going to adapt to who's at the plate, the situation, who's on base. I mean, you say he's a three walk and then grand slam type of guy, or two walk, 3-run home run type of guy. Those are the types of lineups he had in Boston. I mean, if you look at his lineups in Boston, there was no athleticism to those lineups in Boston whatsoever. I
Oh
mean, they
yeah,
had
that
guys like,
it was
and they
mostly
had,
around Ramirez and Ortiz.
I mean, they had Big Pepe, they had Manram, they had
That's right, we are uncensored, so we could say things like that.
Exactly. Veritek. I mean, these guys, I mean, I could beat a lot of these guys in a race, and I think you could beat a lot of these guys in a race.
Maybe you used to be. I
So
don't know.
he
I
had to
saw
rely he had to rely
Ramirez
on
the
his
other day.
3-run home run.
He looks pretty good.
But I mean, this Indians roster is very athletic.
Oh
It,
yeah.
getting back to what we were first talking about, I didn't realize how athletic this team was until you started seeing them play. And maybe it was because they were playing on AstroTurf, but I mean, they looked really, I mean, they sort of, you're going to hate me for this,
I already
but
know.
in an odd sort of way, you already hate me, I know. But in an odd sort of way, they sort of reminded me of of the Minnesota Twins teams of the early 2000s.
I could see that a little bit. I think it, who had the Michael Brantley had the 4-for-4 day against Toronto. I think it was the second day of the season,
Right.
and his first hit was the chopper off the plate. And as soon as he hit it, I was like, well, if he was playing in a Twinkie Dome all year, he'd be batting 400.
Michael, I was just about to say that.
All he has to do
Bourne,
is smash the ball right in front of the plate like they used to do.
if he would have been in the Twinkie Dome, he would have been a 400 hitter.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the.
That's if his legs would have stayed healthy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad they're done with turf. It's such a stupid way to play baseball. It's so unnecessary.
Right.
I mean, here in Phoenix, here in Glendale, they have the football stadium, and obviously they're in a dome because you can't play football in 100-degree weather. But it's a retractable dome. Even the baseball stadium is a retractable dome. When there's no people in there, they open up the dome. It keeps the grass alive. The football stadium, they can actually truck the grass outside of the stadium. They put it in the parking lot. They have like doors on the bottom that they just lift up, and they just roll the grass out into the parking lot so it gets some sun. They can water it out there, and it could grow. There's no reason they can't have grass in Tampa. They can have that weird Florida crabgrass stuff that hurts your feet. Like I don't, they could have something on
It's not, well, no, I think you're, there's no excuse why they can't have it in Toronto, because that's a retractable roof. But Tampa, I mean, that's just a straight dome.
Well, yeah, they need a new stadium, but.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that at this point in time, with the technology they have, every stadium should have real grass. It's silly to have this. I know it was popular back in the past to put down some concrete and lay an inch of rubber on the top of it and call it a baseball field, but that's generally not standard protocol anymore.
Probably the reason why the city of Akron's dying. Not enough stadiums or sporting venues are asking for AstroTurf.
Maybe that's it. I think most college football fields have that, the field turf. And there it actually works pretty well. It kind of softens the blow. Like if you hit the ground, because it's the little tiny pellets, it gives you a better impact. But in baseball, you're not falling on the ground all the time. So you really don't need that. And it gets in your shoes. It's really annoying. It's just terrible stuff.
Now my question is, what happens if you bleed on
Don't know. Nothing.
Just curious.
I've probably bled on it before.
I mean, it's not like grass. I mean, you just can't sweep it on it. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, okay.
What's next?
They just wash it. You can rinse it off. I don't know. You have it next. The game after or the first game in Tampa. The Indians had their brand new, very expensive as far as talent goes, pitcher, Trevor Bauer, through his first Indian start.
Yeah. It was everything I expected, at least, with
Because
the
you did
exception.
predict before the game that he was going to walk the first four batters and tie the Indians' record for most batters walked at the beginning of the game.
Can you do me a favor?
No.
Kiss my ass. All right. Well, from everything that the scouts have said, from everything people like Rick Manning have said,
I
from
believe
Tom
everything he
Hamilton
says. Oh,
during the
no.
spring, and you saw him in the spring, okay, so maybe you can back me up on this, is that he has a lot of potential, but he's very raw. And his breaking stuff was unbelievable. During that Evan Longoria at bat with bases loaded, the count was one and one, I think. He had just fouled a fastball off. And he threw a changeup, which I thought was a fastball, and obviously how
It
well out
was
front,
80 miles an hour.
how well up front Evan Longoria was, I thought it was a fastball too. And I looked at the speed and I was like, wow, it was a changeup. I mean, it coming out of his hand, it looked like a fastball and it didn't even break. So he's got unbelievable breaking stuff. Obviously he's very raw. He has no idea how to hold runners on. When Desmond Jennings stole a base, I believe it was in the s no, because he had a perfect second inning. I think it was the third inning.
It was
I think
actually, it was the third inning,
it was
and
the
he
third
stole
inning.
two bases, and then that's when Luke Marson got the shit kicked out of him, which we'll cover too. But now we're on something else.
But
Yeah, no,
yeah.
he looked great, and the funny thing is, the reason he got sent down, I think more than anything else, was they said he had control issues, and to prove all the naysayers wrong, he walked the first four batters he faced. Like, to prove he didn't have control issues, he could not throw his fastball for a strike at all. And you could just hear listening to the game, Rick Manning is like screaming at him, hoping that he can hear him. Throw a changeup. Throw a fucking changeup. You know, like he can control that, but he wouldn't do it. He kept trying to throw the fastball, he kept throwing balls. And then the thing against the double play in the first inning was fantastic. That had nothing to do with him though. I think he got pretty lucky on that. But then, his second inning was really good. His third inning was okay, although he walked a few more guys again. And then,
Well,
yeah, he gave up two runs in the fourth.
let's try to tie in what we were talking about with the managers here a second ago. Okay. Was his pitch selection, do you think that was coming from the dugout? Do you think that was coming from behind the plate? Or do you think that was coming from the mound?
I would like to think it was coming from Lou Marson because it wasn't good.
Well,
I don't.
if you were accepting, if your phone took text messages, this is what I was going to text you before the game. I hope to God, even though you hated Lou Marson, still hate Lou Marson for various reasons, that he was catching Bauer, because I did not want Carlos Santana catching Trevor Bauer at all. But that's a different story. But it would be interesting to find out exactly where some of those pitch selections are coming from. And I heard, just a little rumor, but I heard the reason why Arizona was shopping him, and they were shopping him. Okay,
Yeah,
that's
we know
confirmed. They
that.
were shopping him,
Yeah.
was because he's uncoachable. He was unteachable, and that many times he would cross up who's the
Miguel
catcher in
Montero.
Arizona, Montero, and whoever was catching him in Double A, that he would basically cross them up intentionally. So, And if Rick Manning makes an astute observation, such as maybe he should be throwing the changeup and his breaking stuff more, and he kept on going with the fastball, it made you wonder where exactly where that was coming from.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that Francona is calling pitches from the dugout. I don't know that anybody really does that anymore. But it may be for a young guy like that, but I still think they probably let the two of them between Marcin and him work it out. I mean, Callaway had a couple visits to the mound, but it wasn't like he was going out there every inning. You know, he wasn't. They weren't really controlling him that much. I think they were mostly leaving it up to the guys on the field. And he got lucky. That throw by Ryan Rayburn deserves a lot of credit, especially considering the fact that Lou Marcin didn't block the plate. When I saw that, I was like, "Yep, that's how Lou Marcin blocks the plate. He stands behind it and lets the guy get in." But luckily, the throw was good enough. He still tagged him out. And then later, we have to talk about the fact that he did block the plate. Finally, for the first time in his career, he stood in front of the plate instead of behind it. And what happened? He got the shit knocked out of him.
But he held on to the
He
ball. The
did,
most
and the guy was
important thing,
out.
he held on to the ball.
And
Are you gonna give him credit for holding onto the ball? Or are you just gonna just am I just gonna say it and you're just gonna blow it off?
if you read my post game, I said I gave him a feathers up for standing in there and making that play.
Okay, no, I read it. I just wanted you to admit it live on the air, okay?
Okay, and I gotta say, I don't hate Lou Marcin, and it gets blown out of proportion the same way Austin Kearns was, you know, a few years ago. I don't necessarily hate these players. I hate the way they're used. I don't like that in the past couple years, even though Marcin's batting 200 or less, the Indians would put Santana at first, let's say 50 times a year or something like that. You know, I to me it was like, fine, do the day game after a night game thing. To give him one day off a week, play Marcin once a week, and put him at first or DH or whatever you have to do with Santana to keep him in the lineup or give him the total day off or whatever. But you don't need to do it every day. Now, last year they didn't have a first baseman. They kind of did, but they didn't have a DH at all, except for the couple of weeks that Pronk was actually with the team. And when he was, he couldn't play more than 2 days in a row. So, you know, the off days worked out together. This year, they have a first baseman. They have a great DH, like as good as a DH as you could want. A guy that can't field worth a shit and can hit really well and strikes out a lot. That's the perfect DH. So they got a good DH. They got a good first baseman. They got great outfielders. So you don't want to move Swisher into the outfield. There's no reason to play Marcin more than once a week. And so far, that's been the case. They played him once in six games. And I don't think he's playing tonight, so once in seven games. I think that's how he should be used. And if he's used like that, and if he bats more than 200, then I'll be really happy with him.
Well, I didn't think Manny Acta had any confidence at all in Carlos Santana behind the plate, so I think that's why he was played as much as he was last season.
There's no reason for that. He's not bad defensively, and I think Marcin was really bad defensively last year. He, like I said, he doesn't know how to block the plate, and he doesn't throw runners out as much as people give him credit for. Like, his percentages, sorry, as caught stealing are worse than Santana's, at least they were last year. So people were given, that's all they kept saying is, oh, he's such a great defensive player. He's so great defensively, and he'd never showed it. I don't know why they would give him the credit. Now, Santana, I don't know if you can't call him lazy, I don't think. But he gives up a few more of the wild pitches and pass balls and stuff, and maybe that's because he doesn't move as quick behind the plate. But the other facets of a defensive game, he's better than Marcin.
Comparing Lou Marcin and Carlos Santana, Lou Marcin gets barreled over by Desmond Jennings. I mean, we're not, he wasn't even, I mean, Marcin wasn't even moving, okay? So he couldn't even direct a lot of that blow back towards Desmond Jennings. He gets plowed over, gets back up, holds on to the ball. Now, he didn't stay in the game, but he's all right. Carlos Santana gets hit in the mask by a foul ball and misses weeks because of a concussion.
Well, if you actually have
I think that tells you everything you need to know about the
Yeah, and
defense.
when and the other a couple of years ago or whatever, when Santana got ran into at the plate and tore his fucking MCL or whatever it was in Boston. Yeah, that's because he's a wimp. Or is it because he
So
was on lockup?
I question Santana, and I always have. I question his durability. I question a lot of things about Carlos Santana. There's no question that he can hit. He's a very talented hitter, but I question his innards, his guts.
You
I
know,
don't think he's...
I like him as a catcher, and until they have a better hitting catcher, I think he needs to remain the starting catcher. Now, if I don't think Yan Gomes is ever going to be anything other than a backup, but maybe Chun Chen or someone further down the line. They actually just moved somebody. I can't. Someone in Double A, they just switched from second base to catcher. I think maybe Walters or something like that.
Tony Walters.
Yeah, I'm thinking that was him. They moved him from second base to catcher. In hopes that, he's obviously looking like a good player, but Kipnis is under control for long enough that they're not really looking for another second baseman, and they have Dorsius Paulino and Francisco Lindor, so they have two shortstops that are going to come up almost at the exact same time. So that they're going to have, if they're assuming that all these guys are actually going to make it to the big leagues, they don't need another second baseman.
Right.
Yeah, so they moved him to catcher. So, if one of these guys can come up. And Santana is still on the team, then you can talk about moving him to first, although Swisher is going to be at first for the next 3 years, and or a DH. Either one of them can move to DH. So then you could talk about it. But right now, I don't want to hear about Santana doing anything other than catching 150 games a year. There's a 140
And
games.
to me, that's a scary thought. I don't think he's durable enough to catch those many games. So I think by some of this minor league shuffling going along, moving positions to catcher, moving certain players to catcher from their old positions, I think the Indians realize that his durability is not that great. And I don't think he's going to catch or has the ability to catch 154 games. As I mentioned in my Yankees preview, I just find it really ironic that both Ben Francisco and Travis Hafner are on the Yankees roster. Not only are they on the Yankees roster, but they're sharing designated hitter duties. I mean, Ben Francisco was in camp with us at the beginning of the year, and we didn't have a spot for him anywhere. And yet, he is now the Yankees DH when they're facing a southpaw. I find that really funny.
Well, and
And for so many years, as Indians fans, we have to put up with, oh, the Indians are just a Triple-A team for the New York Yankees because they draft, sign, develop players, and they go to either Boston or New York. We're just a Triple-A team for these big market teams. And I find it
that's a nice
ironic that
impression.
the Yankees are picking off the scraps of what the Indians don't want anymore, and then they're cracking the starting lineup. It's hilarious.
And it's not just the Indians. If you look at this lineup, it's a who's who of the 2004 baseball season. Just like it's the these guys. The first two guys are homegrown guys. So congratulations to the Yankees. You raised your own Brett Gardner and Robbie Cano. So good job with that. I guess. But then after that, in their lineup, it's all castaways, guys who had trouble signing this year, guys who got traded because they didn't have spots. Kevin Youkilis, who the Indians did want, but they ended up getting something better in Swisher. You've got Pronk, who the Indians didn't want, and intentionally, nobody wanted him. If anybody wanted him, he would have signed anywhere else. He hated New York. At least he always claimed to hate New York. And that's where he had to sign because nobody else would take an aging power hitter who is going to strike out 200 times and maybe hit 10 home runs. And then they have Vernon Wells, who they just got from the Angels because the Angels were going to use him, weren't going to use him. They probably were going to release him. He was their fifth outfielder. Between Trout and the rest of their they had
Well,
Hamilton is in
they signed Josh
right, I
Hamilton. That
think.
didn't have any. So,
Yeah, so they
yeah.
have an extremely strong outfield. Their DH is also an outfielder. Then they had a fourth outfielder, and then Wells was going to be after that. So he was never going to play for them. And he goes from never going to play for the Angels to batting fifth for the Yankees and starting in left field. It's just like, just the same thing with Hafner. He was never going to play for the Indians. Youkilis, he would have been a starter, but he wasn't that great last year, and he is definitely falling off from where he used to be. Then they have, yeah, they have
Go ahead.
Ichiro, who's another guy who had a hard time getting signed this year. I don't think he necessarily wanted to stay in New York either, but he didn't have a choice.
Yeah, for a lot of these guys, he was either signing with the Yankees or drive a Pepsi truck. I mean, yeah, looking at the middle of the Yankees lineup, Youkilis, Hafner, and Vernon Wells. I was texting a friend the other day who is a Red Sox fan, and I was saying the Yankees, it's a possibility they could lose 90 or more games this year, and I would not be surprised. They're going to have players returning, and obviously, with the injuries to Granderson and to Teixeira, so they're going to be getting all-star caliber players back, but they're aging. A-Rod, same thing, they're aging. I'm not saying they
Yeah,
can't compete for
those
a division,
guys,
but I mean, they
I would
could.
say they can't compete for the division. Do you see
Just think
Tampa's
that.
pitching? Tampa's pitching, their 4 and 5 starters shut out the Indians, who were obviously capable of scoring 13 runs the next day. So it's a good offensive lineup, and they got shut out by their 4 and 5 starters.
Right.
So obviously, Tampa has great pitching, and their batting, their offense is not that bad either. And Toronto, again, has an improved offense and pitching staff over last year. So you've got both of them to contend with, and the people who won the division, the Orioles.
Right.
So you've got, three teams there who in the past 20 years have done almost nothing. The Orioles won a couple times back in the Ripken years, but they've basically done nothing in the past 2 decades, and all three of those teams are now in contention.
Yep, certainly not the same Yankees that we grew up with, that's for sure. I mean, they're not intimidating anymore. You don't really, as much as you can fear it being a baseball fan, you don't really fear them coming in. You don't fear their lineup anymore. I mean, they need to rebuild. I hate that.
Well,
It's kind of weird saying
they
that, but they
can't
need to
rebuild
rebuild.
because they finish in first every year, so they don't, or first or second, so they don't get good draft picks. And they keep signing players. When they sign some of these players, they lose draft picks for that too. So they're just never, they can never draft. So even when they do get a draft pick, every once in a while they'll get one up. Look at their best draft picks still, and it's still like the best homegrown talent they have on this team is are Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettitte, and Derek Jeter. And they were all drafted in the 90s because they sucked in the 80s. So they kind of like goes on to that, and they drafted them in the 90s, and they all came up, and that was the last, really good crop of things they had. They did have, Alfonso Soriano, who was a international free agent signing that they let go, and Robinson Cano. So they have a couple new guys, but in general, their team is really made up with a whole bunch of really old, really injury prone veterans. And I just look, I forgot he was on the team. Jason Nix is their utility man.
It is the all 2004 team.
Jason Nix was never good. There was no 2004. There was no nothing. He was not good. And Lyle Overbay is their starting first baseman. Like, I don't understand how they can be okay with this. As New York, as the team that's got so much money, and there were guys on the free agent market the last couple of years who were available, and they still have the highest payroll in the league. They set a new record this year for highest payroll. I don't know how their payroll can keep increasing and the team keeps getting worse. Doesn't make any
Well, something has to give. I mean, it makes you wonder why they didn't even go harder just to keep Nick Swisher for some outfield depth, or to DH at least. I mean,
Well, they do have Ben Francisco.
yeah, who they picked up after we released him. But yeah, but see, here's the thing though, where they can bridge that gap between not having enough draft picks is the international market. I mean, if they scale down
They
and
haven't been doing that.
they have a lot of money, like I mentioned in our preview, they have a lot of money tied up to players that are injured. Okay,
Oh,
so I mean
yeah.
that explains the high
Well, they have
payroll.
the most expensive player in baseball right now, and A-Rod, and he's out. Or at least he has been the most expensive. I don't know, someone might have beat him. But, you know, they're giving him over 20, I think it's 24 million a year or something now after the newest extension. And he's earning about none of it. And then they've got their old trio of guys with Teixeira and Jeter also out.
He's sitting on the, yeah, he's
And I'd be
hurt.
happy if Jeter just sat out the rest of his career. Like maybe if he developed cancer in that broken ankle of his or something,
Hey,
maybe I wouldn't
hey,
mind.
hey, easy, easy.
I've got, you know what? I get like that with Jeter. Again, it's not necessarily him personally, but it's what people put on him. It's the feeling like he's the greatest defensive shortstop in all of baseball and has been for a decade when he's one of the worst defensive shortstops ever. You know? Ever even at the beginning when they got A-Rod and A-Rod moved to third and Jeter stayed at short, A-Rod was such a better shortstop. It was amazingly better. There wasn't even close to who was a better shortstop, and they let Jeter stay there and keep falling on his stomach and keep jump throwing to first, like that's impressive or something. You know who
Well,
didn't
yeah.
jump throw to first? Omar Vizquel.
Well, yeah, I mean, that goes back to Derek Jeter's value overall. I mean, would he have had the same value if he played shortstop for the Kansas City Royals during the span of that time too? And the answer obviously is no.
Yeah, and the thing is, he does hit 200 hits a year, which isn't that common, like, and he has been a good offensive player, and he's been good in the World Series, except for the playoffs in the last few years. But he has been good, but he's so overrated that I have to hate him and wish death upon him. Like that's just now. Mariano Rivera is not overrated at all.
What about A-Rod? You don't think he's overrated? The fact that a lot of those numbers were steroid induced and he hasn't been healthy since that.
I don't
I mean,
believe in steroids.
A-Rod accomplished exactly what he wanted to accomplish in his baseball career. Now, is
A-Rod
the
is
kid
still a
good
narrative
enough
to me.
to be the highest to be the highest paid player in the game? He accomplished that. He got busted for steroids. He doesn't care anymore. He's set.
Yeah, I don't care, but I don't care, but everybody hates him. That's like Bonds. I love Bonds. Everybody hates him, so I love him. I gotta have that little bit of opposite thing in there.
Wow.
But in general, like I think Bonds is probably the greatest person to ever play baseball. I think he absolutely surpassed Ruth and Aaron or any of those other guys.
That's because he could do it all.
Yeah, he played defense. He could run the bases when he was young. He hit home runs like no one else ever. And I don't care what he was doing. Everybody's doing something, whether
Well,
it's
that was
legal
even
or not or whatever, but
And that was
it doesn't bother me.
even before he became a freak. I mean, he could do it all. He could hit for power, hit for average. I
Yeah.
mean, he had all five tools.
Yeah, he was
And
winning
not to mention what he
MVPs
could do
in the early
defensively.
90s. So, I mean, with the Pirates. To me, like those guys, him and Rodriguez, that doesn't bother me at all. It bothers me way more on the Jeter thing. Like in Cano, people can talk about Cano like he's a great player. He is a great player. Give him credit; he deserves it. The Yankees deserve credit for signing Cano, bringing him up, developing him as a player, and making him into a great player. But they also deserve to get that notice that he's the only guy they've done that with. And they've got nothing else. Everybody else on this team is just, you read through it and it's like, okay, they got Kuroda from the Dodgers, they got Sabathia from the Indians, everybody came from somewhere else. And it's actually, this is probably the most guys on our roster that they've brought up, because they do have David Robertson on there now, and Phil Hughes and Jabba Chamberlain, who are all really just totally mediocre. There's like not even Ivan Nova or whatever is pitching a game against the Indians this series too, and
He is.
none of these guys scare me. They're just Andy Pettitte is pitching. I can't believe Andy Pettitte's alive, let alone still in there. He
He
should be
came back. Yeah, I mean
in prison.
he's been thinking about, and he's retired once and well, actually three times already.
He should be in prison for what he did to Roger Clemens.
That's Roger Clemens' wife. Roger Clemens' wife should be in prison for what she did to
Man,
Roger
whatever.
Clemens.
Yeah, so
So we're gonna.
it'll be really interesting this series, and this is actually the only time the Yankees come to Cleveland, so it'll be the only time Indians fans get to boo the Yankees this year. I think it is kind of lucky because they're without their superstars. You know, being that lineup is so weak compared to what it's been ev forever. Like even when they haven't been great since they bought all those players and won the World Series back in 2010 or whatever, 2009, I think it was. You know, that was their last great team, but that was a completely purchased team. Everybody was in their prime year. Like that was the year. You know, that was it. That was set for everyone to share
Yeah, they had to win or else that
and
year, and he
Rodriguez,
did.
all those guys were ready. They won it. And then ever since then, I think it's only been 4 years, the team has just deteriorated. It's like been falling apart, and they've never really revamped. Maybe they sign like Randy Johnson or someone like that, bring him back out. Yeah, I think that's the type of move that really would help this franchise.
So we can wrap this up. I want to watch the pregame
Oh
festivities.
yeah, we are. It's a big game today. Everyone's so excited. The home opener, even though they already played six games, I guess you get excited about the home opener.
I always get excited when I hear Tom Hamilton scream out players' names,
Okay. Well,
including the pregame introductions.
when you're not in Cleveland, the home opener doesn't make a whole lot of difference between. You know, I like the game in Toronto. You know, that was exciting to me. To see Justin go out there for the first time and knock around Dickey. Just had to say that again for you because I know you like it.
I always love when you say Dickie.
Yeah, that's called a callback. So now everyone who's listening to this has to go back and listen to last week's. Let's see if
Oh,
you
is that what that's called, a
can
callback? Man,
find the.
you're getting pretty good at this. What are you listening to, a lot of talk radio or
Yeah, you
something?
could find that somewhere. It's probably going to be very hard to find, actually, once I post this. But if you search back through, you may be able to discover it somewhere. I'm going to like I try to post these in separate articles, and if you go under the Indians arguments tab in the on burningriverbaseball.com, go under the Indians arguments. They should each be posted in an individual article there, so you can listen to each one individually. They're also on Podomatic.com, but I don't really want people to listen to them there.
Yeah, go to our website and listen to them.
Yeah, and if you if you're hearing this, you probably already know, but all the newest episodes are posted on the right side of the website. It's just a little thing. It says Podomatic. It has the title of the episode, and it's got a little play button. All you got to do is hit that play button, and you can listen to them right there. And you can download them from there too as well if you'd rather, you know, listen to us on the road somewhere. So like you're going out and you can hear what we have to say wherever you are, even if you're not by your computer. Because some people do that. I don't. I'd rather just
I
sit and
do.
listen to us on the computer all day. But
I do. I can't sit still when I'm on the computer, so I actually have to be doing stuff.
yeah, so
But
turn
anyway.
you're jumping with jacks and run on the treadmill and listen to us. It'll be a fun time. And
Wait,
don't forget,
are you gonna let me go to watch the pregame stuff or
in a
what?
minute, just be patient. I just want one more thing I want to plug. If you want to hear my thoughts during Indians games or, you know, stay tuned and figure out exactly when we post articles and stuff like that, check out us on Twitter. It's at BRBBLOG. It's Burning River Baseball Blog is what it stands for. And I'm the one that runs that. You can also follow Mike, but he's pretty boring. So I recommend just following the official site one, and that's where you'll get all of your newest updates as far as articles, Burning River Radio, and in-game analysis about who is or isn't wearing sunglasses, why Lou Marcin sucks, just various things like that.
I can't be as controversial as you because my name is actually on my Twitter account. So if I ever hope to get a really good job in the future, I can't post controversial stuff on there because nobody can trace it back to you if you put something on there.
Okay, well,
So.
you know, it's not too controversial. I think everyone knows that Lou Marcin sucks and that you're gay. But anyway, that's all for today.
Kiss my ass.
We will see you next week, hopefully sometime, assuming this continues.
It'll continue.
And enjoy opening day in Cleveland.
Bye.